Becoming the Truth, the Spiritual Life of Richard Rose. Richard Rose was an American spiritual teacher, author, poet, lecturer, and philosopher who taught a path to enlightenment through self-definition. Rose maintained that everyone has the right to know who they are, and that this realization was possible through self-inquiry, retreating from error, and going within to find the truth.
Find the truth. You find it through yourself. You can't get it from reading books, even though they're my books. You'll not find the truth. I try to point a way to a roadmap, but basically, you do not learn anything in this life. You become. We do not learn. We become.
At the age of 30, his search for the truth ended in Seattle, Washington, where his spiritual quest and his growing frustration with life collided with explosive results. But the path that ended for Rose in Seattle began a long time ago, in another day and time when the world was a very different place. 1917. The spring of 1917 brought the U.S. entry into World War I. The spring of 1917 gave the world Einstein's theory of relativity. And the spring of 1917 gave the world Richard Stephen Vincent Rose. Richard Rose was born on March 14, 1917, to Richard Rose Sr., a plumber by trade, and his wife Marguerite Odom Rose. His mother, Marguerite, proved to be the primary influence in young Richard's life. The Rose family lived on a farm, but they later moved into Benwood, West Virginia, a small Ohio river town about 5 miles south of Wheeling. Now, just past the turn of the century, Benwood was a bustling town, fueled by steel, coal, and a railroad hub. But Richard's future would not be shaped by the growing local industry, but instead by his mother, a devout Catholic who believed early on that son Richard was an unusually sensitive child, and she decided that Richard should one day grow up to be a priest. So, in 1922, at the age of 6, Richard was sent to Wheeling's St. Alphonsus Orphanage for his primary education, and he remained there through the 8th grade. As a lecturer, Richard Rose often talked about his early family life and his mother's decision.
The orphanage was because it was a Catholic orphanage and there was a church and a school nearby, and we lived out on a farm, so they stuck me in there so I'd have to be close. You'd have to go to school in the right place.
In 1930, now 13-year-old Richard Rose left St. Alphonsus School after completing the 8th grade. His mother believed that Richard needed the framework of religion, so she decided that in the fall he would be sent to the Catholic Capuchin Monastery in Herman, Pennsylvania, near Butler, for his pre-seminary training that she hoped would one day lead to his ordination as a Catholic priest. Also, by 1930, the Great Depression had caught up with the Rose family. The father had been out of work for months, and sending Richard away to the monastery meant one fewer mouth to feed. Rose recalls that the atmosphere at the Capuchin Monastery was austere and contemplative. He was enthusiastic about entering a place where he believed he would be among people who had direct knowledge and contact with God. But he says, as the years went by, he became increasingly disillusioned with the religious teachers at the monastery and their apparent lack of personal knowledge of God. He recalled asking the monks if they met God, and he started to doubt that the monastery was the place where religious knowledge would be found.
I realized they didn't necessarily have the answer. They had beliefs galore, but no answer. And when I got to be 17, I left, but I didn't stop looking.
So Richard Rose returned to Benwood and enrolled for his senior year of high school at Wheeling Central High. He was a senior at Wheeling Central during the 1935-36 school year, and he planned to go to college if he could somehow scrape together the money. And there at college, he hoped to find answers to those questions that he had not found in religion. In 1938, at the age of 21, Richard entered West Liberty College as an English major, but he focused most of his studies on chemistry and physics. He never finished his studies there. in part because while at West Liberty, Richard fell in love with a girl, the first love of his young life. Their relationship became serious, but it ended abruptly when her father found out and pulled the young lady from college and sent her away. Heartbroken, Rose says he lost interest in studying the sciences and instead decided to plunge into a spiritual quest to find answers wherever that path might take him.
I got into this business of hatha yoga, and I stayed with it for 7 years. Raja yoga, meditational techniques, and in general, I'll never give up my delving into any transcendental thing that came along. Was totally celibate, didn't smoke, didn't drink, because I thought I'm going to go whole hog. If you're going to do something, don't do it halfway.
During this period, Richard explored the idea of immortality, of life after death. But he says he was frustrated by what he found.
I went to spiritualist materializations because I figured if you want to find out what happens to you after death, go to talk to somebody who's died. I searched all over the country through scads of phonies. So what I finally found, I found some genuine materializations. I talked to things who were supposed to be dead and came away like Omar Khayyam, the same door wherein I went.
In 1942, at the age of 25, Richard was working in Baltimore, Maryland, when he received word that his older brother James, serving in the Merchant Marine, had died at sea when his boat, the Delisle, was torpedoed. Rose says he was close to his brother James and considered him a kindred spirit, a seeker like himself.
My brother got killed right off the coast of Florida in a merchant ship, and he had the same drive that I had. He was always trying to find books on philosophy and read them, and we would compare notes occasionally. But when he got killed, it had a rough effect on me.
In part, Rose recalls, because James' death made him see himself as selfish.
I thought to myself, this man was as important as I am or better. And here I'm egotistically going about thinking I'm going to discover a great religious secret or great thing about the human race, and perhaps I'm just an animal, but he's dead and he can't search. He gave his life for people that were still could be left around to search or to make fools of themselves or whatever they wanted to do, but they were still alive because some men were dying.
In the spring of 1943, Rose traveled across the country seeking spiritual knowledge and work, which he found in Ohio at the Curtis Wright Aircraft Plant in Columbus. It was there that he first met Robert J. Martin, who was working as a layout inspector. They became lifelong friends and seekers. Here's how Bob Martin described Richard in Martin's unpublished book, Peace to the Wanderer. He writes, "Back in 1943, Rose dressed like a Catholic priest. He wore a black single-breasted suit, a black topcoat, a white shirt, and a black tie. This was topped by a black felt hat. I sometimes called him Father Rose. Of course, his shoes were black Oxfords. In a sense, I think he had what the Catholic called a vocation." Bob Martin's Peace to the Wanderer contains his reminiscences from their first 1943 meeting forward, and it reproduces dozens of Richard Rose's letters written to Bob over the years. Richard found in Bob Martin a spiritual brother, and over the next few years they often met to talk philosophy, religion, and science. They sought out phenomenal people in groups to investigate, and even then, early on, Richard expressed his desire to form a loose-knit spiritual brotherhood, starting with the two of them. Bob Martin writes that while working at Curtis Wright, Rose had developed a platonic relationship with Jean Hamill, a young female bench inspector. Jean was married at the time, but Rose was nonetheless smitten with her, referring to her as an Egyptian princess. During 1944 and through 1946, Bob Martin moved from town to town seeking short-lived jobs. Rose, meantime, continued his spiritual quest, traveling across the country seeking books and people who might have special knowledge, But he says finding very few people who were genuine, and his anger prompted him to make a pledge to himself that if he ever found something spiritual, he would share it.
I did make that promise that if I ever found anything, I would make it available. Well, I didn't expect anything to happen.
But things were happening for 30-year-old Richard Rose on two different fronts. First, he was feeling that time and biology were catching up with him, and he recalls looking in the mirror and not liking what he saw.
My hair was falling out, my teeth were getting bad, you know. I thought, who in the hell is going to have me in another year or two? I better get married while I'm still presentable.
Worse, he believed his spiritual search seemed to have run out of steam.
I wasn't getting anywhere. You know, after a while, you get aware of it. That might be a magical system, but it's not working on me. I don't know. So I'd get disgusted.
Acting on those feelings, in February of 1947, Rose writes Bob Martin that Jean had divorced her husband, and he was now contemplating marriage later in the year. Rose admitted that for many years, he was still a victim of his ill-fated college love affair, the memory of which had bothered him for a long time. But he said now he felt that he was ready. Bob Martin writes that Rose had been in touch with Jean and that she had asked him to visit her in Seattle. He says Rose took that as a sign that Jean wanted to get married. So not many days after his weekend visit with Rose, Rose took the bus to Seattle thinking that Jean was there waiting for him. Rose recalls that at this point he was in a high state of confusion, frustrated by his lack of spiritual success, feeling the effect of the years passing by. He came up with a cynical plan to give his life a new direction. He decided he would marry Jean for her money.
She was the only child of parents who were millionaires and grandparents who were millionaires. And I thought, this might be comfortable. If she's got money, and she it looks like she might be a little sinful, but I'll change her. See, return for which maybe I can live on her money while I'm writing books.
When Richard Rose arrived in Seattle, he knew something was wrong. Jean was the key to his plan, and she was nowhere to be found. Rose eventually tracked down her apartment, and he decided to pay Jean a surprise visit. But, as he recalls, the surprise backfired.
I surprised her with another woman. So I got on the bus and thought, I made up my mind, I'm going to get out of here. I can't win this business. So I went home and I was still sitting in a yogi posture. You know, I was sitting on the bed with my feet underneath me and I'm reading a book. And all of a sudden I get a pain in my head. And I thought, oh boy, this is it. I didn't know what it was, but I know it's going to kill me.
Here in a 1991 lecture, Richard Rose recalls what happened in Seattle, which began with a fantastic vision and ended with a shattering experience of everything and nothing.
The next thing I realized, I was going out the window. There's a couple of stories up off the street. And I remember looking down at the street as I was passing through the window. And there was a snow-capped mountains in that direction, Cascades, I think they were. And I thought, boy, that's where I'm headed. That looks like a nice place. You know, I like the hills. And away I went. And when I got up there, there were no mountains up there. There was something, but it was a high place, but no mountains. There was no snow. And I stood there for a while. I know I was standing because I felt conscious of being in a vertical position. Wasn't too sure of the substance that I was standing on, but it dawned on me I was dead. And I thought, but boy, what fun. Boy, you can travel, you know. And so I was really exhilarated by it, and then I thought, I wonder where I am. What is this place? And maybe will I ever see the people on Earth again? And I wondered what the thought passed. What would the human race look like? Where are the people? And when I thought that, I could see them coming up the hill in front of me. And as the knowledge came to me, this was everybody that had ever lived. Everyone that ever would live or had lived, this knowledge came to me. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I can see myself. I saw myself in the midst of it, you know. Well, this didn't occur to me until I got later that you're involved now in three people, a body in Seattle, and a guy watching myself in up on top of this high place. But it didn't bother me because I still felt that I could do pretty much of anything I wanted. What occurred to me that I was the maximum. I was absolute. I had absolute access. Whatever I wanted to see, I could see. I thought to myself, this is everything. I'm in control of everything. And then, but what is the opposite? The relative mind had to come back in, the memories of Earth, instead of taking it for as it was. See, and you know, I wanted to know what nothingness was. And when I wanted to know what nothingness was, I fell through a pit that I could see no bottom to. It just passed down through it. And I thought, oh, well, I made a mistake. You know, here goes nothing. And I woke up on the bed in the rooming house, you know, it wasn't a hotel, it was like an apartment house. And I thought, well, that's what I've been looking for all my life, and there it is.
The experience left Richard Rose traumatized. He remembers weeping and walking the streets of Seattle, trying to process what had happened. And finally, he decided to head back to familiar ground in Cleveland, Ohio, where Bob Martin was staying. Bob Martin says when Rose arrived in Cleveland, they spent a couple of days together. He says they agreed that Rose had undoubtedly had the experience of cosmic consciousness, that he observed the nature of objective reality and the mortal Richard Rose, and he found that they were not. Martin writes that it was a couple of months later, after that visit, that Rose wrote about the profound experience in Seattle in the epic poem, The Three Books of the Absolute. Here's how the poem ends, read by Richard Rose.
All that remains is all. The spark of life falls through the canyons of the universe, and my soul cannot weep for its loss, for lamentation and sorrow are things apart. All that remains is all. The universe is past like a fitful vision. The darkness and the void are part of the unknowing. Death shall exist forever. Silence is forgotten, and all that remains is all.
Martin writes that he later pulled out all of the stops on his job promoting Rose and that Rose was hired. He says Rose worked there for about a year, leaving in the fall of 1948 to return to the farm in West Virginia. Richard Rose was now spending most of his time on the farm where he was raising goats and harvesting lumber. But he also continued to promote the idea of establishing a circle of friends or a brotherhood which would explore all things spiritual and philosophical. It was a concept that he had proposed to Bob Martin over a year before, just before the Seattle experience. Rose had asked Bob Martin to be the group secretary and keep the list of group contacts, while Rose pledged to donate the farm as a central meeting place which would be open at all times to the members. A spiritual group based at the farm was an idea that Rose came back to again and again over the following years until it finally came to pass. In January of 1950, Rose wrote Bob Martin that he was busy. Rose said that he was laying the foundation for a house he was building in Benwood, that his father was drunk for a week, so Rose had to stay at the farm to tend the goats and the cattle, that his mother had a stroke and that this had caused some problems. Rose said he had lumber to haul out with his truck, but the tires were flat. But even with all of that, he writes, despite all of the above, I have been giving considerable thought to our venture of the Circle of Seekers. Bob Martin writes in Peace to the Wanderer that he got an unexpected call from Rose on October 22, 1950. Rose denounced his marriage to Phyllis Elizabeth West of Wheeling, the younger sister of Rose's boyhood friend, Johnny West. Martin says it was a May-December marriage. As he recalls, she was 17, and at the time, Rose was 33. While immersing himself in domestic life, Richard Rose continued to ponder his spiritual experience and the path that led him to it. He wrote to Bob Martin in 1951 that it was clear he had reached and retreated from a number of convictions, starting with Roman Catholicism and then spiritualism, and after doubting them, atheism at the age of 21, and then science. And when he doubted those too, he looked for a better path. Rose says he eventually found yoga to be a reliable path, and he formed the conviction then that to reach the inner door, you must retreat. At the age of 40, Richard Rose was now the proud father of Ruth, Kathleen, and James. He was supporting the family with a painting contracting business. While raising his family and running his contracting business, Richard Rose was still immersed in the quest to expand his understanding of his spiritual experience and also to clarify the outlines of a path that he hoped could reduce the number of pitfalls that future seekers would face. So after painting, during the day, he would come home and begin writing. He worked on a series of essays on different aspects of spiritual work. The Albertson Papers, some 15 years in the making, was finally published in 1973 in an 8.5 by 11 stapled edition, soon followed by a bound edition and then a justified edition. During this time, Rose was also reading deeply into the latest spiritual offerings, particularly the writings of George Gurdjieff and P.D. Ouspensky. And he was especially interested in a small book called The Conquest of Illusion by J.J. Vanderloo. In 1959, Rose wrote that, "My enlightenment in Seattle is as close to God realization as any man may come. The conclusion comes from comparing it with accounts in Vanderloo's Conquest of Illusion. Before reading him, I thought no man had experienced the same as myself." Richard Rose's life of family and business and spiritual reading and writing continued into the 1960s, and it brought a new outreach to seekers in the form of a public appeal published in a San Francisco underground newspaper. Rose was offering the farm as a nonprofit, non-interfering, non-denominational retreat, and he specifically asked for young people who might want to settle at the farm and devote some time to getting the thing started. He received a number of responses and invited a handful of people to the farm for a face-to-face meeting. And soon, it was a group of hippie-looking people hanging out in the rural area of Marshall County, much to the concern of the local residents. The situation attracted the attention of a local reporter, who, uninvited, came on the property and started snooping around. The result was this article in the Wheeling Intelligencer. The story sounded amusing, but the notoriety prompted more of the curious to come by to take a look, including two carloads of people a few days later who drove by the farm, yelling, throwing rocks, and shooting a gun. Rose responded to the gunfire by shooting back. Unfortunately, a 17-year-old boy in one car was shot, and Richard Rose was charged in the shooting. The charges against Rose hung over his head for about a year, but were eventually dropped. For the most part, the first experiment in attempting to create an ashram at the farm ended in failure. But one curious result was the appearance of two men from New York. They professed to be disillusioned Hare Krishna members. They convinced Rose to lease a large parcel of land just down the road for 99 years for the creation of a spiritual community. But once the papers were signed, they put their robes back on, and they founded the Hare Krishna community of New Vrindavan, the future home of the Palace of Gold, just down the road from the farm. The next major development in Richard Rose's effort to reach seekers began in 1972 with an invitation to speak at the Theosophical Society of Pittsburgh. Now, that organization, formed in 1875, had the goal of promoting universal brotherhood and sisterhood. Each year, they held a series of lectures, and Rose's Pittsburgh lecture was notable for the attendance of a University of Pittsburgh student named August Turak. Rose recalls that he knew immediately he would be working with Augie.
He didn't look like a philosopher to me. He looked, you know, like somebody that had been out smoking pot or something. But I thought to myself, that's the man. It's going to take the group, establish a group in Pitt University.
Augie and his friend Ray arranged for Rose to give a talk at Pitt. They then set up private follow-up meetings, which Augie volunteered to lead. Augie also started taking others to visit Rose at his farm and home in Benwood, West Virginia. Before long, students from other cities nearby decided to form their own groups, and groups were created at Kent and Columbus, with Augie becoming the coordinator. Rose decided to call the groups the Pyramid Zen Society, because he saw the real Zen approach as a pure, direct mind system for spiritual realization without the need for belief. As Richard Rose began a full schedule of lectures and traveled to work with local groups of seekers, another of his lifelong goals was achieved. The nonprofit TATS Society was founded, and Rose's circle of seekers that he first articulated with Bob Martin in 1947 was now in place. TAT stands for Truth and Transmission. There was to be membership, which included annual meetings at the farm. All of this very much in line with Rose's original 1947 vision. During the next couple of years, the Pyramid Zen Society groups spread to Washington, D.C., Boston, and Providence, Rhode Island, and weekend intensives were added. By the fall of 1975, Rose had appointed Augie to plan and run the lectures and the intensives with help from Bill in Pittsburgh. Meanwhile, Frank, who had previously been the monitor of the Pittsburgh group, became the group coordinator. Another significant development came in the fall of 1975, as a growing number of people started living at the farm ashram, where Rose offered small plots of land for seekers to build personal retreat cabins. By January of 1976, plans were underway for Rose to give a talk in Los Angeles. Augie and Dave Gold from Pittsburgh had begun organizing weekend symposiums, or chautauquas, that featured a wide range of speakers on various topics. And work had begun on a Chautauqua shelter on the farm, which would bring public events to the farm ashram. In 1977, Rose and the group launched a new venture, the TAT Journal, published from 1977 till 1986 as a forum for awareness. A total of 14 editions of the TAT Journal were produced. The group's expansion continued through the end of the 70s and into the 1980s. More cities were added, and attendance at the quarterly TAT meetings on the farm was growing. During this period, Richard Rose, who was now divorced from his first wife, married former student Cece Rose. She says they met at his lecture in Providence, Rhode Island.
I met him after the lecture, and I told him a little bit about my own family. My grandfather lived in Wheeling at the same time his father was doing plumbing work and my grandfather was an electrician. Well, all this I found out more details about later, but we talked a little bit and I told him I had the same last name and I thought, well, maybe our paths will cross again. Then I found out that there were going to be group meetings and I started attending those.
Cece says she later came to the farm for a TAT meeting and then moved to Wheeling after she found work there. And in 1980, Cece and Richard Rose, who was then 63, started a new family with the arrival of baby Tasha. Meanwhile, Richard Rose continued to lecture and to travel, and he continued working with groups and individuals in a number of cities. He also continued to look for ways to find the language to describe his approach to meditation, energy, and the spiritual process of going within. In 1985, a collection of his lectures was published as The Direct Mind Experience. But as the 80s progressed, it seemed that the group efforts to expand the reach of Richard Rose's teaching had hit a peak. It looked like the period of rapid expansion was winding down. So, while he kept lecturing and travel, there were clear signs to Rose that there was trouble ahead. Richard Rose began expressing concerns over the spiritual direction of the Pyramid Zen groups. There was growing conflict between Rose and Augie Turak, his longtime right-hand man, over the operation of the TAT symposiums. Lecture attendance at talks was down, as the Zen brand apparently had lost its appeal. And Rose himself seemed to be running down physically. C.C. Rose says Richard suffered a head injury caused by getting hit by a car while on foot. She believes that that accident marked the beginning of Richard Rose's decline. In 1993, Richard Rose withdrew from the lecture circuit after showing signs of ill health. In the spring of 1994, he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. The years of trying to care for Rose at home eventually became unmanageable, and in 1997, Richard entered a local nursing home and was then transferred to the Alzheimer's unit at the Weirton Geriatric Center. In the early morning hours of July 6, 2005, Richard Stephen Vincent Rose passed away. Former Rose student Bart Marshall wrote an account of the moments leading up to Rose's death. He writes that wife Cece, daughters Kathy and Tasha, and granddaughter Julie, as well as Rose student and friend Mike Kasari, were keeping watch. But, he says, when the final moment came, only Bart, Mike, and a nurse were in the room. Bart Marshall writes, "We stand frozen like statues, watching his breath, even, gentle. Then, a few minutes later, stillness. The duty nurse holds her hand to his neck, then nods. What time is it? Mike says. 5:50. Don't know if my watch is right. It's the standard now. 1 minute AR, I say, after Rose. We laugh. This is the only place I ever wanted to be, Mike says, at his right hand. I touch Rose's head and say a silent goodbye. Bart writes that Cece, Kathy, Tasha, and Julie made their way back to say their final tear-filled goodbyes and were preparing to leave when Kathy said, "Wait." She fishes in her purse and she hands me a camera, Bart writes. "Get the three of us." The Rose girls wipe their cheeks and get their smiles ready. "Dry your eyes," Tasha says. "This is for Daddy." Granddaughter Julie played the violin as Richard Rose was buried at the family farm in Marshall County, West Virginia, with Lee Warfield officiating.
My hope is that someday, so I'll be able to find somebody that said, "Hey, I want to put the rest of my life into this," and then I'll put the rest of my life in, if necessary, to try to steer that guy in the right place.
Richard Rose may or may not have found the person that he was looking for so intently, but his lifetime spiritual investment is paying off. It's paying off in the many students who worked with him or with his teachings and have become the truth and are now teachers in their own right. His work lives on through the TAT Foundation that continues to hold 4 spiritual retreat weekends each year so that the circle of seekers and finders can find each other. And Richard Rose's lifetime investment continues to benefit new generations as they discover his direct, no-nonsense approach to awakening and as they work in local study groups across the country and around the world. Peace to the wanderer.